You don't know the whole story. It's complicated.
Seems complicated, yeah. Except not. I mean, it makes sense. Your work schedule, your control issues.
Where does your mother think you are right now?
Oh, it's fine. She thinks I'm at Lewis's studying. Yeah, I left a note. It's not a great lie, but I haven't had your years of experience, so.
Are you enjoying this?
Yes. Yes, I am.
This isn't some game, Philip. This is everyone's lives you're playing with.
Well, lucky for you, you have a spare.
You know, I don't expect you to understand, but I did this for you and your sister. Sisters. Brother, does sound strange.
Hello and welcome to Gayest Episode Ever, the podcast where we talk about gay episodes of classic sitcoms, but that's actually not what we're doing today at all.
What are we doing, Drew?
Well, my co-host Glenn Lakin can't be here today.
What? I'm right here.
Because instead, it's special guest Glenn Lakin here to talk about his new movie, Being Frank, which opens when, Glenn? Tell me when it opens.
Oh, it opens this weekend, Friday, June 14th.
Which is Flag Day.
What flag?
I guess that's up to you, right?
Sure.
Glenn is celebrating Flag Day with his new movie. It's a very patriotic thing. And it's called Being Frank. It stars Jim Gaffigan. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Anna Gunn.
Correct.
Samantha Mathis.
Yes.
Logan.
Miller.
Who plays your teenage protagonist, and he's very good.
Yeah, he's phenomenal.
And he does very entertaining talk show visits.
Oh, well, yes.
Yeah. Glenn, how do you explain Being Frank to people?
Being Frank is about a teenage boy who discovers his dad's secret second family and gets pulled into the lies to protect it.
But it's not a dire, like, it's angsty thing.
I mean, kinda, but kinda not. It's it is a comedy, or as the kids sometimes say, dramedy.
Mm-hmm. I'm familiar with that portmanteau.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it's a weird little movie. And I think, I mean, I like it. I've had to see it like now 4 or 5 times, and I don't hate it yet.
That's good. A lot of people have a really hard time watching their work on screen. So the fact that you can sit through it that many times and like not claw your eyes out is says a little bit about you.
I think I ruined my pants by digging my nails into them this last time.
I'm guessing that is actually not hyperbole.
No, it is not.
Well, I'm sorry that was so pants ruining for you.
Well, here's an interesting thing about Landmark Theaters, where the movie is playing, is that the seat numbering system, at least at the one at the West Side Pavilion, is odd. I was given seat N1, which you would think would be an aisle seat. It is not. It is dead center. So I had no escape.
I'm so sorry that they pulled you that way. I realized that that is not your optimal like theater seating.
No, it is not.
Well, you survived. That's good. And yeah, it's playing at Landmark Theaters, which means if people want to see it, it's playing in which cities this weekend?
The cities, it is just Los Angeles and New York.
Okay.
You know, the best cities.
Mm-hmm.
Not true.
Oh, you're going to say something about Chicago now?
I mean, Chicago's the best. And it is actually playing in Chicago the following weekend, June 21st, along with, Glenn takes out his phone, looks at the list, Washington, D.C., Dallas, Pasadena, and 3 different theaters in San Francisco. And I didn't even think San Francisco was that big.
It's not physically, but I guess they have a lot of theaters. They're all crammed in pretty tight.
And then on June 28th, Glenn scrolls down to a different picture. It is playing in Albany, Boston, Philadelphia, Indianapolis, Minneapolis, St. Louis, Jacksonville, Denver, and 2 theaters in San Diego.
That's a pretty good spread.
I have friends in like a fourth of these places.
That's good. So if you're listening and you live remotely close to any one of those cities, please go watch Glenn's movie. He worked really hard on it and it's good.
For a long, long time.
Well, that's my next question. First of all, if you want to see about other screenings of the movie, they're all going to be posted at the website. Is that correct?
Yes. You can go to beingfrankfilm.com. Although right now, for some reason, they are not showing the Los Angeles screenings. So you can just go to the Landmark Theater's website and they should be able to direct you to show times, tickets, and parking information, I'm guessing.
Parking's important. So yeah, this was in the works for a long time. Where did this story come from?
I came up with it as a pitch when I was working in Ron Howard's Imagine Writers Lab, which was sort of a ragtag group of nine screenwriters that got together and wrote features kind of alongside each other, not really together. I had a whole list of ideas going into it that I wanted to pitch, you know, like mid to big budget family adventure or things like that. And I sat down and my producer and the woman running the lab, Karen Cahila Shearwood, said to me, oh, Ron and I were actually looking for like a modern day John Hughes, which sent me into a panic attack. That's a tall order. Mm-hmm. And those movies to me were all about teen rebellion and learning different perspectives. And I don't know why I came up with the idea of a man with two families being discovered, but I did. And I think for me, it was when I looked at the issues that bothered me as a child and as a teenager, I think I always idolized other families and assumed other families were not better than mine, but different in ways that I kind of coveted, mm-hmm. like large family gatherings, family vacations. Mm-hmm. You know, families like on a sitcom that got together a lot. So originally, this movie was sort of a grass is greener tale for me.
It still kind of is, too.
It definitely is. I think now seeing it for the fourth time fully, I think it's more about escapism for me and how escapism is an inherently selfish act.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's still funny to watch, but every time I see it now, it is sort of like I kind of feel guilty for the things I put the characters through, which is maybe an odd reaction to have.
I, despite the image you put out there, I think you are a very empathic, caring person, and that seems like the reaction you should have, because you created these characters and you care about them, and then you make them go through some shit.
Yeah. And you know, the script in the movie treats it with a lighter tone than you'd expect.
Because mm-hmm. This could be like a very, this could be like a In the Bedroom or something written by a different person.
Right. I mean, I love In the Bedroom. I often imitate Sissy Spacek throwing a dish onto the floor, screaming everything.
I think about her slapping Marissa Tomei all the time.
I should say on the record that my father does not have a second family that I know of.
It seems like he would have told you by now, right?
I don't know. Maybe. We talk about other things.
Right.
And a lot of people have come up to me to tell me about their second families and the people in their lives who have second families. So it's a thing.
Wait, really?
Yeah.
How do you even have that conversation?
Well, in every Q&A, at least one person has said, oh yeah, my uncle or my neighbor or so-and-so had a second family. And usually it's discovered at that person's funeral. Like,
yeah,
there's just like a lot of guests that people don't know.
Yeah.
I was like, who are those people?
Oh, that's so weird.
Yeah. I think how the film sort of relates to our podcast and what talking with you on a weekly basis on the podcast, I talk to you like every day outside of the podcast, but I think our conversations about sitcoms have actually made me realize that I think through writing this, I was trying to talk about sitcoms and how they influenced me and how they influenced how I viewed families, and especially the patriarchs of families.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a surprise that there's a sitcom trope of the father being sort of a terrible bungling idiot who gets a lot of slack because he's well-meaning.
And he's a white man.
Yes, he is a cis straight white man. Mm-hmm. And I think this movie sort of wants to explore that and pushes that to probably the limit and beyond about the forgiveness we're willing to give the men that we welcomed into our lives on a weekly basis from the comfort of our homes. And I think in the context of a movie, it's very different because it's not 22 minutes. It's almost 2 hours.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to experience the fallout of these seemingly comic betrayals.
Yeah, it takes it to a further extent than you would see in a sitcom. And it turns out that, like, oh, these people all have feelings, and their feelings kind of get fucked around with because this zany misunderstanding is not actually as funny as it might be on Three's Company.
Yeah, and I think this is actually something I've been prodding with my work for a long time. I co-wrote a short film in grad school that was not well received for many qualified and good reasons. But there was a moment in the film where the co-writer, who was also the director, and I wanted to elicit laughter, and then a half second later, a gasp, and for people to sort of question why they are laughing at something horrible. And we got the exact reaction we want, and people were very angry with us for doing that. And I think there's a shred of that in this movie. And there's not just a shred, that's what the movie is.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I think some people think I am taking light of the situation in the film.
I'm kind of surprised by that because I thought, at the very least, the two female leads are Samantha Mathis and Anna Gunn, both of whom do a very good job, and both of whom seem like rounded people. And you see how this betrayal really does affect two people who were just trying to be happy people. And it's kind of, I'm not going to say it's a bummer because that's not the right thing, but like, it's a deeply felt thing.
Yeah.
So when we were actually talking, I think earlier today, about TV connections and sitcom connections, and it felt like something that you maybe didn't like consciously process until recently that there was a sitcom tie-in. Is that correct or no?
Yes and no. I don't know that I realized I knew I was referencing sitcoms. Mm-hmm. I didn't know how deeply integral to the sort of messaging it was. My writing, because I grew up on sitcoms, and that's sort of the pattern of dialogue and the pacing of comedy and scenes, naturally has influenced my writing for better and worse. Like, I think with a lot of the things I do, I put up like cellophane between the work and the audience, which is on one hand necessary to get them to accept some outlandish circumstances or the heightened quality of dialogue or the circumstances. And that can cut both ways and keep them separate from the emotional resonance of what I want them to experience or feel. So I think tonally, I'm always trying to pull back from sitcom writing. Mm-hmm. Like, that's just my natural reaction. It's a reflex. Sometimes a reflex when I talk, and I just have to keep myself in check. And so I think in writing Being Frank, there are a lot of like sitcom qualities to the scenes and to how people deal with each other.
No, I was just going to say that because, as we talked about in the Three's Company episode, Three's Company was something that is basically the reason we are friends.
Yeah.
And also, we just did that episode like 2 weeks ago. And thinking of that as being something that derives entertainment out of people not all having the correct information, someone putting up a lie and living a lie. And from the very genesis, I've read this script years ago, and it seemed to me to be like a very like, oh, let's take the zany misunderstanding and then like put some feeling behind it. That's always what I thought this was to me. And it was just interesting that that's something that didn't hit the writer quite that same way.
I was always aware of it. It's just, I don't think I ever would have pitched it to someone as, I mean, I would probably pitch it to you like that, but I don't know that I would have walked into a room and said, let's do Three's Company, but instead of Jack confusing and enraging two girls he wants to go on a date with, it's a man who's led a double life for almost 20 years.
Right.
But that's basically what it is. It's like, take a sitcom construct, put something truly horrible behind it, and then stretch it out and make someone sit through it while still trying to get them to laugh.
So you wrote the script back in 2011. Did it go through any changes between then and now?
What? Changes? No, it was perfect first draft. Actually, no, it went through. Yes, no, it went through a lot of changes, but it always sort of remained the same. We had a different director attached at first, but then in around 2013, I met with producer Miranda Bailey from Cold Iron Pictures about a different project. And after hearing her sort of story and what her business model was, I pitched her what was then called You Can Choose Your Family. And she liked it so much, she wanted it to be her directorial debut. And so I worked with Miranda and her producer, Amanda Marshall. We sort of just talked through the script, and Miranda had a personal connection to the subject material mm-hmm. that I did not. And I did some rewrites based on their notes. And then I just sort of handed it off in 2014. And by the time I arrived on set, it was just sort of fingers crossed that the scenes were where I left them and the characters were still who I remembered them to be.
Were they?
Yes. Which I guess, I don't know, is my hopeful message to other screenwriters, because, you know, this is a collaborative business and being rewritten is the nature of the game. Mm-hmm. And the only way to protect yourself is to put out a product that can't be replicated or can't be, I don't know.
Monkeyed with without like completely breaking it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's also sort of my brand, is I write myself very difficult to execute scripts, which
some people might call that writing yourself into a corner, Glenn.
Yeah, it definitely bites me in the ass a lot, but when it works, if it works, I think that protects me somewhat from turning the things I write into something completely different. But it also makes my own rewrites completely infuriating, as you have seen me pace and scream at myself.
I'm familiar. What do you hope people take away from this movie when they go see it? And they should go see it. When they buy a ticket and watch yes. it and buy a ticket.
Please buy a ticket.
Yeah.
I already talked about the escapism, mm-hmm. I think. And that also ties into gayest episode ever. You know, back in 2011 when I wrote the first draft, I probably deeply wanted Philip, the main character, to be gay. But that was a different time mm-hmm. in filmmaking. And I think people still saw this as potentially a bigger movie. And so...
They mean like a mainstream studio release.
Yeah. Yeah. Back when Hollywood is still clinging to the idea of a mid-budget comedy, mm-hmm. especially when this was at Imagine. And so through that, like, you know, we all have things that we think will be fixed by running away from our problems. We think a change of scenery will change us. We think getting away from the toxic people in our lives will change us.
Well, I mean, you should do that anyway, but yeah.
Yeah.
Point taken.
Yeah, but there's also, I don't think we always take stock of the collateral damage when we're so focused on how am I going to get myself out of this bad situation? And I'm not talking about like serious things like a war zone. Like, yeah, get out of there. But like existential dread and crisis, you know, when a teenager is so focused on getting out of his hometown just to chase some sort of dream. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's not really thinking about his parents or his siblings or his friends. And then I guess the other takeaway is, I mean, thank you. I mean, thank you for going to see it and yeah. hearing what I have to say. Mm-hmm. And also, it's just a very strange but wonderful thing to finally see it. And I think a lot of people who listen, maybe, I don't know why I'm wildly guessing that people out there have creative endeavors, but like, you've seen me go through shit for this thing.
Like literally since I've known you.
Yeah. And so, I don't know. Suffering for art is a terrible, terrible stereotype. And it shouldn't be a thing, but sometimes it is a thing that happens. And I'm not saying that this film coming out makes the suffering I went through worth it or justified, mm-hmm. but I acknowledge it, and I'm happy that it didn't, like, at any point, I didn't throw in the towel with this movie.
No, you really didn't. You could have moved to, like, some podunk town and just, like, worked at a gas station. No, like, shade against gas station attendants, no. But, like, you stuck this out, and now it actually is a movie that people can buy tickets for this weekend.
Yeah, and also, just because we're having a conversation about it, we also agree that art is divorced from intention. So whatever I intended for the audience to see and feel with this movie, they're going to feel however they want about it. And that's cool. And I'm happy to have a conversation about that.
Well, Glenn, if people do see this movie and are just infuriated by it, what's your Twitter handle?
I Write Wrongs. That is right with a W. And on Instagram, I'm at Bros Quartz.
So yell at him there. Also, we will also accept polite, informed discussion about the nature of this film.
Yeah, okay. I do love talking about it.
Yep. I am Drew Mackey, Drew G. Mackey, M-A-C-K-I-E on Twitter. And you can follow this podcast at Gayest Episode on Twitter. Listen to all our previous episodes at gayesteepisodeever.com. Is there anything else you need to say?
Go see my movie.
Go see this movie. Have a great weekend and interview podcast over.
Bye forever.
Thank you for coming out all this way, by the way.
Mm-hmm,
yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Cakes production.